Deadline's Iran's foreign minister says there can be an agreement in the Vienna talks if the U.S. makes a political decision and end its maximum pressure policy. Iran urging the UN to officially condemn the recent assassination of a member of its armed forces, as a report by New York Times says Israel was behind the killing. And also in our headlines, Lebanon's Hezbollah chief warns that Israel's continued aggression against the Al-Aqsa Mosque could result in a regional flare-up. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this sapphire, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, says in order for the 2015 Iran deal to be revived, there are certain steps that the United States needs to take.
The most important issue is that economic sanctions against Iran need to be removed in an effective way. The maximum pressure policy of the Trump era needs to be lifted. We have kept the window of diplomacy open in order to reach a good and lasting deal. We are determined and we are serious about it. And it has always been us, the Iranian side, that has put initiatives on the table. We have intelligence that the Zionist regime has taken the foreign policy of the United States hostage. Mr. Biden should make the decision. Does he really want to waste the time, or does he want to be brave and return to the commitments under the JCPOA?
Amir Abdollahian was speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos. He said Iran is committed to striking a good deal, adding the economic guarantees of the U.S. are a very important part of any future agreement. He noted that Iran should be able to trade normally with other countries without any impediment. According to Amir Abdollahian, the administration of President Joe Biden is following the lead of the previous administration, adding it imposed sanctions on Iran even as the revival talks were underway in Vienna. Earlier, journalist and political commentator Abbas Aslani joined us. He said the United States cannot continue its maximum pressure policy on Iran while, in words, returning to the 2015 nuclear deal.
They want to use the leverage of pressure, sanctions, sabotages against Iran while they claim that they are involved in a diplomatic process. The problem is that the United States wants to keep the maximum pressure policy intact while in words returning to the nuclear deal. And these two things cannot, let's say, happen at the same time. If they want to return to the deal, what Iran argues is that they have to practically return to the JCPOA commitments. They claim that some of the issues raised by Iran are beyond the JCPOA, but let's not forget that many of the sanctions, including the labeling IRGC as a foreign terrorist organization, was done in order to create a wall against any U.S. president to return to the deal. So that's related to the deal, and but they want to keep it in place in order to have a leverage of pressure against Tehran in future, to get more compromises in future, and to somehow create some leverages in order not to let the Iran to benefit economically from the JCPOA.
Iran is demanding an official condemnation from the United Nations over the assassination of a member of its armed forces a few days ago. Colonel Hassan Sayed Khodai, a member of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, was shot dead outside his home in Tehran on Sunday. And now Iran's UN ambassador has sent a letter to UN Chief Antonio Guterres, urging the world body to denounce the killing as part of its responsibility in the fight against terrorism. Majid Takht-Ravanchi says certain regimes are seeking to advance their agendas with a systematic assassination of Iranian citizens and scientists. He says such state-sponsored terrorism is openly challenging the rule of law, and an international silence will only embolden the perpetrators. Based on U.S. media reports, Israel has informed U.S. officials that it was behind the killing. Israel's footsteps have already been traced in a number of attacks on Iranian nuclear sites and the assassination of its scientists. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement hails the victory over Israel in the year 2000, saying it was an unprecedented achievement for the resistance. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah was delivering an address marking the 22nd anniversary of the liberation of southern Lebanon from the Israeli occupation. He said the victory thwarted the regime's project for creating Greater Israel. The Hezbollah leader said Israel is a barbaric entity that only pretends to be civilized. Nasrallah said Hezbollah has been fighting to protect Lebanon and its people without having any intention to grab power. The Hezbollah leader added that the resistance movement does not seek permission from anyone to protect the country. He also warned Israel about continuation of its aggressions against Al-Aqsa Mosque. Nasrallah said any aggression against Al-Aqsa and other sanctities of Muslims will cause an explosion in the region. Lebanon marks the Resistance and Liberation Day on May 25th every year. Hezbollah forces drove Israel out of southern Lebanon in May 2000, ending over two decades of the regime's occupation.
May 25th marks the 22nd anniversary of Lebanon's liberation from the Israeli occupation, a national holiday seen by many in Lebanon as a true Independence Day. Dr. Nazia Saleh is from a small town on the southern border. The Israeli aggressions began in 1948, but intensified in 1982 when Israel's invasion reached the capital, Beirut.
During the occupation, we were suffering a lot. We cannot go to our villages. Like, I'm from South Lebanon, I couldn't go. I couldn't go to South Lebanon, to my village.
She recalls how in the early hours of the full-scale invasion, news of resistance operations began, and that the liberation would be the outcome, although hard to believe.
People, they didn't believe that. Nobody expected that Israel will withdraw. Israel, through history, when they occupy a land, they don't withdraw. They don't leave it because they are stealer. But what happened in Lebanon, it was a surprise. It was a very, very, very nice surprise. So people, till now, they don't believe what happened. But the answer is the resistance.
Israeli troops began their withdrawal on May 24, 2000. The masses marched to their hometowns and villages, forcing the Israeli collaborators to flee their positions. When the first rumors of an Israeli withdrawal spread, people from all areas rushed to the buffer zone. Many of those people's hometowns had been under occupation for more than 20 years. It was the people's spirit, along with continuous resistance operations, that secured the first ever unconditional withdrawal of the Israeli army since 1948. Former Lebanese detainees in Israeli jails say this liberation is the only national holiday that was truly Lebanese and paid for with so many sacrifices.
This is the only holiday we believe in, and forcing the Israeli enemy to withdraw with no agreement or preconditions is a historic and unprecedented event which we paid a heavy price for. With all the backing that this enemy had from the U.S. and the West, the resistance was capable of achieving this victory.
Hezbollah leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has stressed that the future challenge for the resistance group is liberating the Shabaab Farms and Kfar Shuba Hills, which were occupied by Israel in 1967, as well as liberating Lebanon's natural resources, which have become part of bargaining efforts by the U.S. mediators. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Afghan health experts are sounding the alarm over the deteriorating healthcare system in their country. They say Afghanistan will soon run out of medicines if urgent actions are not taken. Rahmatullah Baghman reports from Kabul.
Rights groups warn that people are dying from lack of medicines in Afghanistan. Afghan Medicine Services Union also says that medicine supplies in the country are running low and that no medicine might be available to the patients within the next 2 months.
Afghanistan is facing an unprecedented drug shortage and a sharp rise in drug prices. These days we are supplying drugs from our stocks and reserves, and I'm afraid they will run out of medicines within the next 2 months. This situation has hit our nation, health sector, and drug sellers.
The union blames the banking crisis, major cuts in global aid, and U.S. sanctions for the medicine shortage. It also called on the Taliban to allow traders to import medicine in any possible way.
Medicine shortage is rooted in different problems. Firstly, most world countries have stopped medicine export to Afghanistan since the Islamic Emirate is not recognized worldwide. Secondly, major amounts of drug importers' money is freezed and banks in New York are not cooperating. Thirdly, the Taliban have imposed certain restrictions on drug imports.
Patients in Wazir Akbar Khan Hospital in Kabul complain about their inability to provide medicines, calling for help from the international community to save their lives.
I am from the Jawzjan province. I have brought my child for treatment in this hospital in Kabul. I have been here for 5 days and I have spent all my money on services and medications. Some medicines are very hard to find and some very expensive. The doctor has given me this prescription and I am wondering how to provide the drugs.
This comes as Afghanistan is facing multiple outbreaks of diseases, including COVID-19, measles, and acute malnutrition. Afghan hospitals and clinics are running out of medicines. Doctors here say urgent action is needed to save the lives of patients. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Well, China says it has no intention of installing a military base on the strategic Solomon Islands. In the South Pacific, Chinese minister says a security agreement Beijing sealed last month with the tiny Pacific state was, quote, above board with honesty and integrity. Wang Yi said the recent pact is not targeted at any third party. He said the agreement helps the Solomon Islands government safeguard stability and long-term security. Wang Yi made the remarks in Honiara, where he is on the first leg of his tour of the Pacific Island states. The minister said China's cooperation with the Pacific Island countries does not target any country and should not be disrupted. The U.S. and its allies, including Australia, accused China of forging military ties in the region and seeking to build a military base on the Solomon Islands. The U.S. has been shocked by another tragic mass shooting. A gunman has shot dead 19 young children and two adults at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas. The gunman has been identified by law enforcement as 18-year-old Salvador Ramos.
The U.S. has been shocked by another deadly shooting incident. A gunman has shot dead 19 young children and two adults at an elementary school in the U.S. state of Texas. The carnage happened at a school in the city of Uvalde. The gunman has been identified by law enforcement as 18-year-old Salvador Ramos. The teenager is suspected of shooting his grandmother before the rampage. A U.S. Border Patrol official who was nearby when the shooting began rushed into the school and shot and killed the gunman. The shooter was wearing body armor as he carried out the attack.
I was just devastated. It's heart-rendering for us as grandparents. We have children in the age vicinity that happened here. It's overwhelming.
In a speech from the White House, U.S. President Joe Biden said he was sick and tired of responding to mass shootings as he called for gun control. This is the deadliest U.S. school shooting since the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting in Connecticut, in which 20 children and 6 staff were killed. The bloodshed has revived calls for gun control measures in the U.S. School shootings have become recurring emergencies in the U.S. There have already been 27 school shootings this year alone. 26 school shootings were recorded last year. The massacre at Robb Elementary School happened only 10 days since several people were killed in a racially motivated mass shooting in New York.
A Ukrainian far-right military regiment hit the headlines after Russia launched its military operation in the country. Our correspondent in Mariupol, Johnny Miller, tells us how the extremist group is engaged in the Ukrainian conflict.
The notorious Azov Battalion, officially part of Ukraine's National Guard, their neo-Nazi roots are well documented, as are many of their crimes before the war started, such as the use of torture. Nazi-affiliated insignia remains a common sight on their clothing. Their base was in Mariupol, overlooking the Sea of Azov. They defended it fiercely against the Russians, but lost. Amongst the ruins, some anti-Azov graffiti. It reads, "Death to Fascism," and some more graffiti, perhaps written by an Azov member. It sums up their ideology. Life is slowly returning to the city, but people here will live with what they saw for the rest of their lives.
Yes, I witnessed Azov killing civilians. It was in Kurchatov Street. They were shooting from there, shelling blocks of flats, private houses, everywhere.
Each had 3 bazookas and a machine gun, and they started shooting. I can't say where they were shooting because they locked us in the basement and warned if we attempted to leave, they would shoot us in the head. So we sat in the basement. The walls were shaking and they were firing with everything, with those American javelins as well.
Ask anyone in Mariupol who was here during the fighting and they will likely tell you stories like these, of Azov targeting civilian houses and of the use of hostages and human shields.
It's striking that everybody I've spoken to today here in Mariupol has no criticism of the Ukrainian army, who treated them well, gave them food, helped them evacuate, but that it's Azov, the Azov battalion, who mistreated them, using them as human shields and shooting them, targeting them.
The Ukrainian military have an aim to defend civilians, and they do it. But Azov ignore these rules, and they humiliate people in different ways. Once I saw them pull two women from the streets and drive off somewhere.
This is Konstantin Ivachenko, the new mayor of Mariupol.
We are finding traces of their crimes gradually. In the area of Mariupol airport, there are brutal places. There was a prison called the Library, and all people who disagreed with the neo-Nazi point of view were tortured there.
Have you found any NATO weapons with Azov? Is there evidence that NATO has been arming Azov?
Yes, sure. We found Stingers and Javelins. After the city is reconstructed, we will put them on show. We have a lot of them. Lots of Javelins.
While thousands of Azov members have either been killed or have surrendered in Mariupol, they remain a powerful influence in Ukraine, not least because unlike many Ukrainian soldiers, they are ideologically driven to fight the Russians. As NATO weapons flood the country, many of them will find their way into the hands of extremists. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Deep insight and firm determination, the most outstanding qualities of Hazrat Hamza. On January 25, 2022, Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, met with the officials of Hazrat Hamza International Conference. This is a part of his speech with the managers of this conference. A personality like Hamza is an unknown personality. He is not well known. The first thing that can be said about that great personality is that he is not truly recognized. Besides, the commander of the faithful, greetings be upon him, mentioned him as well in a narration in Nur al-Thaqalain, which is based on a narration in Al-Khisal. Of course, I saw this narration in Nur al-Thaqalain. I did not look it up in Khisal. In my opinion, this is an important narration. Imam Baqir alayhi salam, greetings be upon him, quotes the commander of the faithful, greetings be upon him, as saying, I made a covenant with God Almighty and His Messenger, me, my uncle Hamza, my brother Ja'far, and my cousin Ubaidah. Of course, it is a long narration and this is only a part of it. Ubaidah ibn Harith, whom no one knows, was one of the three people who fought in the beginning challenge during the Battle of Badr. Later on, he was martyred too. No one knows him. The commander of the faithful mentions him as well. Me, my uncle Hamza, my brother Ja'far, and my cousin Ubaidah. He says that they made a covenant with God upon an order and we adhere to it for God and His Messenger. Greetings be upon him and his household.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They agreed upon an issue and made a deal. The commander of the faithful, as well as his uncle of the Holy Prophet, that is Hamza, was 2 or 4 years older than the Holy Prophet, and he was also the Holy Prophet's foster brother. The commander of the faithful made a covenant with his uncle, his brother, and his cousin over a matter that was naturally jihad until martyrdom. It means that they would continue that path until they were martyred. Afterwards, the commander of the faithful says, "And we fulfilled it for God and His Messenger. God's greetings be upon him and his household. But those three overtook me. Those three comrades preceded me in being martyred. I was left behind until God Almighty wanted me. Among the believers are men who have been true to their covenant with God. Of them, some have completed their vow and some still wait, but they have never changed in the least." The commander of the faithful quotes the Holy Quran, chapter 33, verse 23.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all
fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A 21-gun salute was performed in the honor of the Iranian president as Oman's Sultan Haitham bin Tariq received Ebrahim Raisi, who was on a one-day visit to the Persian Gulf country. The high-ranking delegations representing the two countries held discussions before the meeting between the two heads of state was held. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, was also among the high-ranking delegation. He met with his Omani counterpart, Saeed Badr al-Busaidi, on Monday. The Iranian president said dialogue and cooperation among regional nations would create security, noting that the presence of foreign forces not only won't serve to secure the region, but will threaten peace too.
I think first and foremost, it's important to highlight that it's significant that the first visit for the Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, to the to the neighboring countries is to Oman. Oman is renowned as the Switzerland, if you like, of the region, a country that enjoys good ties with everyone, a country that tries to stay neutral, a country that tries to be the facilitator and mediator in a number of contentious issues. And Oman has strived to maintain these ties, whether it's with Saudi Arabia, with Iran, with UAE, with Qatar, across the entire spectrum. And this is what leads many to believe that this visit by Iran to Oman is testament, of course, one, to this ability of Gulf states to have good ties with Iran, and two, as a model through which Gulf states can have ties with Iran and which Iran can have ties with Gulf states, a relationship that respects the integrity of one another, and in a relationship that boosts economic ties, and a relationship that tries to promote dialogue first and foremost, as opposed to trying to settle scores.
Ibrahim Raisi further welcomed what he called Tehran and Muscat's remarkably similar stance on a multitude of matters. The Iranian president hailed the visit as one that opened a new chapter in the bilateral relations between Iran and Oman. An Iranian delegation of 50 tradesmen and economic operators traveled to Oman last week in order to pave the way for the development of economic and trade ties between the two friendly countries. Iranian Minister of Road and Urban Development, Rostam Qasemi, announced that Oman and Iran are going to sign a transportation agreement in order to establish a joint shipping line and tourist flights between the two countries. The two sides signed 13 documents and memoranda of understanding in such fields as energy, politics, transportation, diplomacy, economy, tourism, sports, and the environment. Oman is also seeking to import gas from Iran by building an offshore pipeline between the two nations.
Renew Iranian access to the global economy. And part of that, or part of the Iranian considerations, is to find a reliable partner that it trusts in order to help to facilitate that re-access or rehabilitation into the international markets. And Oman, being a country that is particularly trusted by Iran, that has good ties with Iran, that has proven time and time again, or rather this relationship has proven time and time again, to be a steady relationship between Oman and Iran. Iran wants to utilize Oman's unique position in the region, not just in terms of its strategic location, but also with regards to its international free trade agreements, with which Oman enjoys even with the likes of the United States. The idea being that Oman is a good hub through which to essentially propel Iranian goods or Iranian businesses or Iranian investments, or even to receive investments from abroad via Oman, via a trusted partner.
Iran and Oman have agreed to form a committee to jointly develop the Hengam oil field, which straddles both countries' sea borders. In 2005, both countries signed a memorandum of understanding to jointly develop the Hengam oil field, but the agreement did not materialize. This is why the Iranian president said the trip marked a departure, as the documents and memorandum of understanding will be implemented this time.
The Labour victory ends nearly a decade of Conservative rule in Australia. Minister Scott Morrison conceded defeat after an election on Saturday, and the opposition Labour Party was set to end almost a decade of Conservative rule, possibly with the support of pro-environment independents. Anthony Albanese says he wants to make Australia greener and less hawkish. He said he wanted to unite the country. He told his supporters, "I think people want to come together. Look for our common interest, look towards that sense of common purpose. I think people have had enough of division. What they want is to come together as a nation, and I intend to lead that." Labour has secured a parliamentary majority in general elections, but Albanese may still need a coalition partner to rule. He has indicated that they'll be picked from like-minded independents. The new Labour government promises to reset Australia's relations with the world. Albanese has also promised to create stronger ties with Asia. He said, "We live in a region whereby in the future we will have China, India, and Indonesia as giants. We need to strengthen that economic partnership, and one way that we can do that is by strengthening people-to-people relations as well." Labor has promised more financial assistance and the robust social safety net as Australia grapples with the highest inflation since 2001 and soaring housing prices. The party also plans to increase minimum wages. Others will be watching closely to see if Albanese's premiership brings a less hawkish tone on China, and whether ministerial meetings with Beijing resumes after a more than two-year hiatus. On the foreign policy front, it has proposed to establish a Pacific Defense School to train neighboring armies in response to China's potential military presence on the Solomon Islands. In late April, the Solomon Islands signed a security pact with China. The outgoing Australian leader was highly critical of China in particular and Asian countries in general. He had earlier accused his main opponent of being Beijing's preferred candidate. Relations between China and Australia have strained since 2018 when Australia became the first country to ban the Chinese telecom giant Huawei from its 5G wireless networks. Australia has long been known as the lucky country, partly due to its wealth of coal and gas, as well as minerals like iron ore, which have driven generations of economic growth. But it's now sitting on the frontier of a climate crisis, and the fires, floods, and droughts that are expected to become more extreme due to the rising global temperatures. Labor wants to tackle climate change with an ambitious 43% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. It also has pledged to reach emission net zero by 2050, partly by strengthening the mechanism used to pressure companies to make cuts. To speed up the transition to renewable energy, Labor plans to modernize Australia's energy grid and roll out solar banks and community batteries. But despite its net zero commitment, Labor says it'll approve new coal projects if they're environmentally and economically viable. The Conservative government had been called a climate holdout by the United Nations Secretary General after outlining a plan to get to net zero by 2050 by creating massive new gas projects. Incumbent Scott Morrison had said he would back a transition from coal to renewable energy, but had no plans to stop new coal projects.
Oh, the legacy is awful. We have the worst climate change policies on the planet, courtesy of this government. They were promoting new coal mines. A huge part of their argument was we had to open up more mines as fast as possible. So it was, you know, crashing headlong into climate change and denying any role in it. Foreign policy was a joke.
Elena Doohan, the United Nations' special rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights, who was on a mission to Iran from May 7th to 18th, has described U.S. sanctions on Iran as unjustifiable and inhumane.
Iran has been subjected to a broad scope of unilateral sanctions for a long period of time already. In particular, the United States has imposed economic, trade, and financial sanctions on Iran since the late 1970s, with a comprehensive trade ban since 1995, and measures to isolate Iran from the international commercial and financial system. These were expanded in mid-2000, and again after 2010, extending to many economic sectors.
U.S. sanctions also targeted Iran's central bank as well as commercial banks. The EU adopted restrictive measures and comprehensive economic and trade sanctions against Iran in 2010, supplemented by an oil embargo in 2012, and trade prohibitions involving key sectors and the freezing of assets of the Iranian central bank, Iranian shipping and shipbuilding sector, and a number of persons and entities, and restrictions on financial services, as well as exports and imports. In May 2018, Washington unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, under which the international sanctions on the Islamic Republic were eased in exchange for Tehran putting limitations on certain aspects of its nuclear activities. The U.S. then reinstated harsh economic sanctions on Iran and slapped new ones that barred countries and international firms from working with Tehran. Doohan said The U.S. continues to ban trade and investment in Iran, forcing foreign companies to leave the country for the fear of the sanctions. Many banks and businesses, including pharmaceutical and medical companies around the world, overcomply with sanctions out of fear of potential penalties. The UN rapporteur stated that overcompliance with U.S. sanctions could strip Iranians of their basic rights to health. The top UN human rights official highlighted that applying extraterritorial sanctions on Iranian companies or companies working with Iran is illegal under international law. Duhan added that the sanctions have also hampered Iran's effort to import life-saving medicines due to restrictions on banking transactions.
Human rights in Iran are severely affected by the use of unilateral sanctions. The most close to every single individual's fear is the fear of health. The situation in Iran is the following: that some medicines are produced domestically, at the same time the raw materials are imported. And then it comes the issue again of payments, deliveries, the quality of delivered raw materials. When it comes to the rare or severe diseases, there is no possibility to deliver that.
Commenting on Iran's frozen assets abroad, the UN official said the assets estimated to be around $120 billion need to be unblocked. Duhan began her 11-day visit to Iran on May 7th, a day before the fourth anniversary of the U.S. illegal withdrawal from the JCPOA. She also referred to stalled negotiations in Vienna to bring the U.S. back to the JCPOA, urging the signatories and the U.S. to resume the negotiations. In the end, Duhan called on sanctioning states, the U.S. in particular, to abandon their policy of maximum pressure against Iran and other countries. Economic sanctions are the policy tool of choice for the United States to force countries to bend if they don't follow Washington's foreign policy objectives in many cases. Yet they have failed to bring the desired result, as they might generate some meaningful behavioral change in the targeted or sanctioned country about 40% of time.
We know that sanctions really don't work as far as convincing or having leaderships of different countries change their decision-making or their behavior. So I think over the years we've learned that nothing's going to change with the continued sanctions.
Unilateral sanctions have endangered the humanitarian situation and people's livelihood in Iran, while further affecting the vulnerable strata of the society. In sanctioned countries like Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, Syria, and Yemen, medical equipment is rather outdated, and they suffer shortages of medicine and protective means. One of the reasons is that payment systems are not available to buy and have medicine enter the respective countries. For instance, Iran was the scene of a serious economic and health crisis hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. The embargo put in place by the United States threatened the lives of many Iranians. In what has been termed economic terrorism, Washington attempts to use sanctions as a leverage to overthrow the legitimate governments of other countries, something it has done in the case of Venezuela and Cuba. Whether direct or indirect, most of the U.S. sanctions are not authorized by the United Nations Security Council, and many of them are imposed unilaterally by Washington. In fact, more than two-thirds of the world's countries officially condemn U.S. sanctions as a blatant violation of international law and the UN Charter.
On Thursday, leaders of Sweden and Finland, two European nations that opted for neutrality for years, flanked U.S. President Joe Biden while he threw his support behind their bid to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, at the White House.
And today I am proud to assure them that they have the full, total, complete backing of the United States of America. Today, my administration is submitting to the United States Congress reports on NATO accession for both countries so the Senate can efficiently and quickly move on advising and consenting to the treaty.
I don't think those nations really ought to be scared of Russia. That would be really stupid if they were. Maybe they are that foolish and believe the narrative going on. I think it's more there's a power play. I mean, you look at the sanctions, that's where you really see the intent. And President Biden said this in Poland. He said, we intend that Russia's economy will be half of what it was over years. So that reveals he's planning to continue this for years. Zelensky, even if he were inclined to negotiate, will not be allowed to do it. And I think there's an intent to force governments to pick sides.
The move comes amid objections by Turkey, a NATO ally, and warnings by Russia. Ankara opposes Finland's and Sweden's accession to the military alliance, citing their longtime support for groups Turkey deems terrorists. Moscow, however, has warned of retaliation if Finland, a country that shares a 1,340-kilometer-long border with Russia, joins NATO. Russia's deputy UN representative, Dmitry Polyansky, went so far as to say that the two nations could turn into potential targets for Russia if they become NATO members. Finland and Sweden say they decided to join the NATO and reverse decades of military non-alignment after Russia attacked Ukraine. But Russia considers NATO's eastward expansion a threat to its national security. The issue was a critical reason Russian officials say pushed Moscow to launch its military operation in Ukraine in February. As the war between Ukraine and Russia entered its fourth month, the U.S. Senate passed a $40 billion bill to provide assistance to Ukraine. 86 senators voted for the bill, while 11 others, all Republicans, voted against it, citing its high price tag and the fact that it might not be offset. The bill earmarks $6 billion for arms to be purchased from contractors and sent to Ukraine. It also increases the presidential drawdown capacity from the $5 billion the Biden administration had originally requested to $11 billion. The drawdown capacity allows the president to send away arms and military equipment directly from U.S. stocks at times of emergency.
It used to be the case when you had votes for sanctions against Russia, it would only be two senators voting against. So I think the revolt against this policy is growing. And I can tell you from the campaigning I've been doing and speaking with hundreds of American voters, Americans do not want this war. They don't support spending all this money on weapons. They may not have a completely elevated view of it, but their inclination is to say, we are suffering here. We're paying $1 million a gallon for gasoline. We're running out of baby formula. Why are we doing this? And I want that to be known around the world that the American people are not represented by the policies of this administration.
The war and the subsequent sanctions on Russia have sent shockwaves across the globe, threatening the most vulnerable economies in the world that have yet to recover from the economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's also creating a new global crisis, food shortages.
This is not just about Ukraine. This is about the poorest of the poor around the world who are on the brink of starvation as we speak.
The whole world, including the U.S. and its allies, is paying the price for the war and its ensuing events. The situation would only get worse if the conflict continues indefinitely. The economic, political, and military pressures against Moscow don't seem to contribute to any compromise from the Russian side. The U.S. has expressed its opposition to a prolonged war, but actions speak louder than words.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
last savior.
Oh, the savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Light of Allah, you are a true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. I am your humble host, Zainab. Today in our studio, we have with us Islamic researcher, Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome to our program. In the previous session, we discussed so many narrations from Sunni scholars who had quoted from Abu Huraira or Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, saying that when Imam Mahdi, ajallahu ta'ala farajahum, will come, he'll fill the world with justice, and until and unless he won't come, the world will not come to an end. Well, today we want to discuss some of the narrations. We discussed the narrations from these two companions. Are there any more Sunni narrations in this regard?
Sure. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we are talking about the narrations in Sunni sources, which talk about the fact that the Holy Prophet has said regarding Imam Mahdi that his name is like my name. But they do not refer to the name of his father.
His father.
Because Ibn Taymiyyah claims that according to some narrations, his father's name is like the Prophet's father's name. That is Abdullah.
Abdullah.
But we want to prove that no, many Sunni scholars, they have quoted
narrations
from different companions of the Prophet, which are exactly like the narration in Shia sources.
All right.
Without reference to the father's name. And that is why I'm quoting from different people to show that how many are these narrations.
Yeah.
So as you mentioned, we quoted the narrations which are quoted from Abdullah bin Mas'ud and Abu Huraira. The third one, the third companion of the Prophet, is Hudhayfa bin Yaman. He has also quoted one narration from the Prophet in which the Holy Prophet says, "Ismuhu ismi," his name is like my name.
My name.
And he doesn't refer to that claim that his father's name is
like that
Abdullah.
Of my father's name.
And according to this narration, then Salman Farsi, he stood up and said, "Min ayyi wulik," O the Prophet of God, Mahdi is from which of your children?
True.
And according to this narration, the Holy Prophet says, "Huwa min wuldi hada," from this child of mine, wa daraba biyadihi ala al-Husayn, and he put his hand on Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam.
Right.
Referring to the fact that Imam Mahdi is from the offsprings of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. This is another companion of the Prophet, quoting this narration. We can find it in many Sunni sources like Iqd al-Durar by Maqdisi al-Shafi, 1 in 1, page 82. Because of the shortage of time, I'm not able to quote all the people who have quoted this narration. I suffice with referring to the name of the companion of the Prophet who is in the chain of the narration.
True.
The fourth one is Abdullah bin Umar, the son of the second caliph. He also has mentioned a narration in which the Holy Prophet says, "Yakhruju fi akhir zaman rajulun min wuldi." In akhir zaman, in end of the times, a man from my children will come. We'll have a kind of uprising. Ismuhu ka ismi, his name is like my name, without referring to the father's name. This is in Iqd al-Durar, 1 in 1, page 95. Another companion of the Prophet in this regard is Ibn Abbas. He also mentions a narration from the Prophet in which the Holy Prophet only mentions that yuwato ismuhu ismi.
Mm-hmm.
His name is like my name. And also from the next companion of the Prophet in this regard is Abu Sa'id Khidri. According to this narration, Abu Sa'id Khidri says that the Holy Prophet said, "Ismul Mahdi ismi," the name of Mahdi is like my name. And also we have from Imam Ali alayhi salam in this regard many narrations in Sunni sources which are quoted from different people. For example, Abu Dawood Sajistani in his As-Sunan, he narrates the following narration from Imam Ali alayhi salam. In one part of this narration, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that the Holy Prophet said, "Sayakhruju min sulbihi rajulun yusamma bismin nabiyyikum," the name of the person who will come in the end of the time is like the name of your Prophet, that is Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family. So I think these narrations are enough to
exactly
reject the claim of Ibn Taymiyyah. His claim is that the Shia, they have distorted the narrations by omitting that part of the narration which says that his father's name is like the Prophet's father's name, that is Abdullah. But we see that so many companions of the Prophet, they have quoted the same narration, and many Sunni scholars, they have quoted all these narrations from different companions of the Prophet in their sources. So there is no claim of distortion. Now we go to the next part of the claim. One might say that, okay, we have this version, but according to another version in Sunni sources, the Holy Prophet has said that Ismu Abihi Ismu Abi, his father's name is like my father's name. What about these narrations?
So, Dr. Karimi, for now, we quoted the narrations from different companions of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him. One was Abu Huraira, and then was Ibn Mas'ud, and then Ibn Abbas, and then you said Abu Dawud also narrates from Imam Ali al-Islam. So, there are a lot of narrations which say, his name will be like my name, but we did not find anywhere saying the narration quoting that his father's name will be like my father's name.
In Shia sources, it's not
mentioned.
It does
not exist at all.
We have some narrations in Sunni sources which have this addition, that Ismu Abihi ka Ismu Abi or Ismu Abi. His father's name is like my father's name. That is Abdullah. Yeah.
Dr. Karimi, we'll answer that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand year old
So we said that Ibn Taymiyyah has two claims. The first claim is that Shia have distorted the narration by omitting that part. We proved that no, this is not the case. Because so many Sunni scholars, they have quoted this narration without that part. Is he ready to accept that all these great Sunni scholars, they have distorted the narrations? Of course not. Now we come to the second claim. At the end of the day, we have these narrations in some Sunni sources which have this
part
addition,
there.
This part, that his father's name is Abdullah. So first of all, I mentioned before that as Shia, it's not necessary for us to answer this question because we do not believe in the authenticity of these narrations. None of them has been quoted in Shia sources. But for our dear Sunni brothers and sisters, I would like to prove that even from Sunni perspective, these narrations cannot be relied on. Why? I'll explain from different aspects. The first point is that I'm talking from a Sunni perspective.
Sunni perspective.
We have some narrations in which we have the phrase Ismu Abihi Ismu Abi, his father's name is like my father's name, it is Abdullah. But the point is that when
their hair is a must analyzation part. We must analyze seasonally.
So the chain of the narration of all these narrations, according to Sunni sources and according to Sunni criteria, is also weak.
All right.
I would like to mention a couple of people in the chain. For example, one of the people who has quoted this narration is a person called Tamim Ad-Dari. He mentions, he quotes a narration from the Prophet. In one part, the Holy Prophet says, the days and nights will not come to its end until a person from my progeny will come. Ismuhu ismi, his name is like my name.
My name.
Wa ismu abihi ismu abi, his father's name is like my father's name. Now, it is very interesting that we have great Sunni scholars who themselves, they have mentioned explicitly that this narration is fake, is forged.
All right.
This is not an authentic narration. For example, Ibn Hibban Busti, one of the great Sunni scholars, after quoting this narration, says that لَا يُشَكُّ مِنْ هَذَا الشَّانَ سَنَعَتُهُ أَنَّهَا مَوْضُوعَ. There is no doubt about the fact that this narration is mawdu'. Mawdu' means a narration which is fake, which is forged,
true,
which is not, authentic at all. This is mentioned by At-Tamimi al-Busti in his famous book Al-Majruhin Min Al-Muhaddithin, volume 2, page 34. Zahabi, who is a very great Sunni scholar, in his book Mizan Al-I'tidar, volume 4, page 106, he also says that it is mawdu'a, it is a forged narration. The same has been mentioned by Sayuti in Al-Masnu'a fil Ahadith Al-Mawdu'a. This book is about collecting the narrations which are forged, which are fake. One in one, page 424. Abu al-Faraj bin al-Jawzi, he also says that Hada hadithun la yasihu an Rasulullah. This hadith is not an authentic narration from the Prophet. And many other people, I'm not going to mention all the names. So this is the first narration from Tamim ad-Dari. The Sunni scholars, they themselves have mentioned that this is not an authentic narration. The second person who has been mentioned in the chain of the narration is Muawiyah bin Qurra. He also mentions a narration from the Holy Prophet, according to which the Holy Prophet has said, لَتُمْلَأَنَّ الْأَرْضُ ظُلْمًا وَجَوْرًا, the earth will be filled with injustice and oppression, and then until a man from my progeny will come, ismuhu ismi, his name is like my name, and ismu abihi ismu abi, his father's name is like my father's name.
All right.
This has been mentioned, for example, by At-Tabarani in Al-Mu'jam al-Kabir, volume 19, page 32. Again, interestingly, some Sunni scholars, they have mentioned that this is a very weak narration. For example, Manawi, the famous Sunni scholar of Hadith in Faidul Qadir, volume 5, page 262, he says that this narration from Qurrat ibn Iyas has been quoted from Dawud ibn al-Mihbar from his father, وَكِلَاهُمَا ضَعِيف, both of them are weak. So another Sunni scholar refers to the fact that this narration is not authentic. Weak. Other people in the chain are also weak, like Ahmad ibn Muhammad, like Dawud ibn Mihbar, Mihbar ibn Qahdam, and so on and so forth. So this is the second person quoting this narration. The third person who has quoted this narration is Abu Tufail. He quotes from the Prophet that Al-Mahdi ismuhu ismi, wa ismu abihi ismu abi. Mahdi, his name is like my name, and his father's name is like my father's name. Again, when it comes to the chain, we have a couple of people in the chain who are weak, according to Sunni criteria, like Abdullah bin Luhay'a and Maymun al-Qaddah. Quickly, let me refer to another chain, which is quoted from Abdullah bin Mas'ud. In one of the chains, we have Alqama bin Qais and Ubaidah Salmani, and a couple of people in the chain are weak. And also from, Asim has quoted it from Zarr ibn Hubaysh, from Abdullah bin Mas'ud. In it, again, you have a couple of people who are weak. We prove that there are some authentic narrations in Sunni sources in which we have only the first part
of the story.
And the second part is not mentioned. We mentioned that Tirmidhi has quoted this narration, and he says that Hada hadithun hasanun sahih. This is an authentic narration. When it comes to the second group of the narrations, we cannot find even one narration with authentic chain of the narration.
True.
So even if we want to analyze these narrations from a Sunni perspective, based on Sunni criteria, we cannot rely on the second group of the narrations, and we need to rely only on the first category of the narration, according to which the Holy Prophet only has mentioned that his name is like my name. He doesn't refer to the name of his father.
So, Dr. Karimi, we